Hi, this is Sarah Jackman, legal editor of EG, and I'm joined by
Jess Harold, deputy legal editor at EG.
Jess, thanks ever so much for joining me today. It's been another interesting year in the courts, with a number of Supreme and High Court decisions handed down, a number of those of great interest to the profession. Today we're bringing you our 10 most important, ranging from eagerly anticipated Supreme Court decisions to those that have caught practitioners a little bit by surprise.
But before we begin the top 10, a few honourable mentions. First, Dreamvire UK Limited versus Mishkondareya, a firm and another. A decision from 20th December 2016 that properly emerged in early 2017 and understandably loomed large over the early part of the year. In cases of fraud, the ruling effectively put the onus on the innocent party solicitors, not the fraudsters, causing unsurprising concern in the industry. The appeal, scheduled for February 2018 and to be heard alongside another fraud case, P&P Property Limited v Owen White and Catlin LLP, is easily one of the most anticipated for next year.
Right. And second, one of the most significant outcomes of the year was unfortunately a settlement, not a judgment, in the case of EMI Group Limited versus ONH Q1 Limited. Many in the profession had hoped the case would be considered by the Court of Appeal following the High Court decision in 2016 that a tenant cannot assign its tenancy to a guarantor. Brian Johnson of Dentons outlined the problem, which sadly was not to be solved by the Court of Appeal, describing the fundamental problem with the Landlord and Tenants Covenants Act 1995 as interpreted in EMI as being that it is hostile to the concept of freedom of contract. He said, "What is striking is that the judiciary recognises this flaw, but has left it as a weeping sore, and a sore it shall remain until another case arises."
Lastly, in the honourable mentions, we can't have a review of the year without mentioning one case that dominated the early part, and was expected to provide a true blockbuster decision for 2017, but at the time of recording, has yet to materialise, 8 months after the trial ended. I am talking, of course, of Mark Holyoake v. The Candy Brothers, a hard-fought clash of property developers which must surely have broken the record for the most stories on EGI from a single trial. Either Mr. Justice Nugent has a Christmas cracker for us in store next week, or we will have to revisit this one in 2018's year-end review. Now, on with the top 10 of actual decisions from 2017, counting down in traditional fashion from number 10. It's rare to see a celebrity case name in a property dispute. In 2015, we did have Gordon Ramsay, and this year it was Vivienne Westwood, who successfully fended off a rent hike on her Mayfair flagship store because the consequences of a side letter were considered an unfair penalty. The February decision in Vivienne Westwood Limited v Conduit Street Development Limited was the first time the High Court has decided a case on penalties in a landlord and tenant context, and it won't be appealed, so landlords and tenants will need to be aware of its implications. Writing for EG, Mark Redding and Claudine Adeyemi of Mishkondareya LLP, who acted for Vivienne Westwood Limited, said, "The outcome here depended on the specific facts and, in particular, the wording of the side letter. Not all termination provisions in side letters will now be unenforceable. However, when issues arise in relation to historic arrangements, or when new ones are being negotiated, parties should consider carefully whether the terms are likely to be caught by the penalty regime. This is particularly so in circumstances where the side letter is entered into at the same time as the lease." They added, "The law of penalties will continue to invade property law, and it is important that practitioners are able to identify when a clause may be caught by the penalty regime."
At number 9, when is a building a house? It's one of those questions that would seem easy to answer until the law gets involved, and it was raised yet again this year in Grosvenor Mayfair Estate versus Merricks International Ventures Limited in the field of enfranchisement. The Court of Appeal, in March, was faced with a substantial Mayfair property, originally constructed as a house, but which had for many years been used both for commercial, office and residential use. Was it a house reasonably so called for the purposes of the Leasehold Reform Act of 1967? The Court found yes. As a result, it upheld the County Court decision of Judge Gerard that the evidence of past office use did not detract from the quite overwhelming residential character, identity and functionality of a still grand Mayfair townhouse. It won't be the last time the courts are asked what is a house. that as a court of appeal decision, it will be short of the enlarge in submissions in future such disputes.
Our number 8, Minerva Wandsworth Limited v Greenland Ram London Limited, involved in eye-catching, and indeed eye-watering, award of damages, payable by the defendant, a Chinese state-owned real estate developer, to the claimant, another developer. In June, the High Court ordered Greenland to pay almost $3.8 million in damages in an overage dispute over the site of what was Britain's oldest brewery, sold by Minerva to Greenland for $135 million in 2013. Mrs. Justice Rose ruled that Greenland had been in breach of the agreement by refusing to enter into a revised Section 106 agreement with the London Borough of Wandsworth. Writing a practice point on the case, Alison Colby explained that the judge took the view that Minerva, seller of the site, had used reasonable endeavours to, as required, minimise the affordable housing contribution associated with an enhanced planning permission, and that revised Section 106 obligations were proportionately no more onerous than the original obligations. As a result, the buyer had wrongly refused to execute the new Section 106 agreement, in breach of the overage agreement. It's a case that shrewd developers will no doubt take very seriously.
Lucky number 7 is another Court of Appeal decision in the always hotly litigated residential leasehold sector, Elm Court, RTM Co Limited versus Avon Freeholds Limited. This caught the eye of our legal notes writer James Driscoll as an important decision to dissuade landlords from bringing procedural challenges to right to manage claims. He quoted Lord Justice Lewison's opening of the February judgment. It is a melancholy fact that whenever Parliament lays down a detailed procedure for exercising a statutory right, people get the procedure wrong. In this decision, the court allowed an appeal by leaseholders and found that two procedural errors in a right to manage claim did not invalidate it. James said, "It is hard to believe that mistakes will not continue to be made in right to manage claims, but that this decision may discourage landlords from challenging claims where trivial defects are uncovered. In his view, Elm Court may prove one of the most important decisions yet on how to determine challenges to the right to manage. It should have a major impact on how the first-tier tribunal property chamber and on appeal the upper tribunal lands chamber deal with right to manage disputes."
Six now, and one of the most discussed cases of the year, was certainly S. Francis Limited v. Cavendish Hotel London Limited, a July High Court decision of Mr. Justice Jay, with no shortage of professionals looking to offer their thoughts. As Benjamin Faulkner of Wilberforce Chambers, who acted as junior counsel for the tenant, put it, "Opinion is divided. Some practitioners consider it entirely unremarkable. Others view it as the end of the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954 as we know it." The case involves ground F of Section 31 of the Act, and the landlord's right to refuse a new lease where it wishes to redevelop. Here, the evidence was that the landlord's motive for redevelopment was solely to get rid of the tenant, and the judge found that the requisite intention nevertheless existed. As Benjamin put it, "If this case stands, advice to landlords in ground F cases is likely to change dramatically. For the first time, there is clear authority that the landlord's underlying motive of wanting to be rid of its tenant is irrelevant. Confident in that knowledge, landlords will no longer feel that they ought to justify the works by reference to the benefits they will bring. Instead, they will frankly say that they just want rid of the tenant and have been advised that the scheme of works ought to do the trick." No wonder the judge granted permission to appeal and also a leapfrog certificate. So the issue looks set to be addressed by the Court of Appeal or even Supreme Court next year. Watch this space.
The decision in Orientfield Holdings Limited versus Bird & Bird LLP reminds us that reporting to clients requires attention to detail, skill and judgment. That's how Alison Colby began her practice point on the May judgments of the Court of Appeal, number 5 in our countdown, upholding a ruling that the solicitor's firm, Bird & Bird LLP, was negligent in failing to tell the prospective purchaser of a mansion in St. John's Wood about a planned academy school development nearby. Giving judgment, Lady Justice Gloucester said that it should have been perfectly obvious to anyone reading a Plan Search Plus report carried out that the school development was, or was potentially at least, highly significant. Allison took the view that the appeal decision imposes even more exacting expectations on solicitors than the first instance decision did. Lady Justice Gloucester had said that a proper summary of the search results would have highlighted the development and explained its potential significance, and not merely have repeated basic information from the planned search report. Allison said that the suggestion that it may not suffice to repeat basic information from a search report will concern practitioners, asking what is required. Practitioners would be advised to tailor the analysis in their reports to reflect the terms upon which they have agreed to act, the results of the particular searches made, and the demands and needs of individual clients.
For now, and a decision in Persimmon Homes Limited and others v. Ove Arup and Partners Limited. An appeal by developers against a decision that their engineers had no liability for unexpected quantities of asbestos found on site. It went down well with legal notes writer Stuart Pemble of Mills and Reeve. Indeed, he found it very difficult to think of anything negative to say about, save for the fact that it needed to go as high as the Court of Appeal to confirm that limitation and exclusion clauses in the contracts the parties signed up to should be enforced. Summing up the significance of the May decision, Stuart said, "The robust rejection of those arguments by the Court of Appeal, as well as Stuart Smith J at first instance, should give significant comfort to the parties drafting and negotiating construction contracts for projects big, small and in between, that the courts will respect and enforce the terms of the agreement that you reach." He added, "Going forward, I hope that the courts adopt this approach with as much judicial alacrity as possible. While I accept that different considerations might apply in a contract between a business and a consumer, two commercial parties entering into a contract are entitled to have the terms they have agreed upheld."
We head into the top three now, with a relatively new entry in the list, only one handed down at the end of November. Nevertheless, the Supreme Court decision in Tita International Limited in liquidation versus Davilia Surveyors Limited has fast established itself as a major one in the valuation field in cases of refinancing. The court allowed an appeal by Mayfair Surveyors firm Davilia Surveyors and ruled that rather than the $3 million claimed by the lender, its losses were limited to less than $300,000, the difference between the sum loaned on the basis of the first valuation not alleged to be negligent and the higher sum loaned following a second valuation months later. It's a good ruling for surveyors, but not for lenders. David Stevens, real estate litigation partner at Norton Rose Fulbright, said that Lord Sumption has fortunately restored the common sense application of the but-for test to a refinancing scenario, sensibly concluded that the lender cannot recover that part of the loan that had previously been advanced on the basis of an earlier non-negligent valuation, and that would have been lost whether or not the refinancing transaction had proceeded. He said, "This is a victory of substance over form, and should make it easier for lawyers to advise litigants about their likely recoverable losses at an early stage in proceedings." Juliet Shulker, a partner in Debenhams Otway LLP's commercial disputes team, put the decision in context, saying, "It's important to remember that this decision does not extinguish a lender's ability to bring a claim against a negligent valuer where the valuation was provided for refinance purposes. It merely limits the quantum that lenders can claim to the top-up advance." And she added that, "No doubt this judgment will prompt lenders and their lawyers to think of innovative ways to maximise recoveries to ensure that the loss incurred on the first loan does not fall down a black hole."
At number two, the planning case of the year, or rather two cases combined, was undoubtedly a Supreme Court decision that is a bit of a mouthful. Suffolk Coastal District Council v. Hopkins Homes Limited and another, and Richborough Estates Partnership LLP and another v. Cheshire East Borough Council. The court ruled on the meaning of paragraph 49 of the National Planning Policy Framework and its relationship to the tilted balance in paragraph 14 of the NPPF to be applied in the absence of a 5-year supply of housing. Simon Ricketts, partner at Town Legal, which acted for one of the successful respondents in the case, said that the issue at stake was subtle but crucial for promoters of residential development in areas that cannot show 5 years' supply of deliverable housing sites. He described Lord Carnwath's analysis of the issue as vital stuff that changed what had been the orthodox approach to the paragraph 49-14 conundrum. He added, "This is the highest court in the land telling us to be less legalistic about the way we frame our arguments
as to the application of national and local policies to development proposals. The exercise is not so much a close technical examination as to whether policies are relevant policies for the purposes of paragraph 49, but a weighing up of the consequences of a housing supply deficit against policies which are restricting that supply. Even Jonathan Clay of Cornerstone's Barristers, who was instructed by the technically unsuccessful Suffolk Coastal District Council, added that this was a welcome decision not only for the clarity that it brings to a complex and much fought-over area of planning law and policy, but also because it asserts in the clearest terms the primacy of the development plan and the policies of the local plan, through which local people can shape and protect their own environment while accommodating the development they need. Martin Edwards, of Cornerstone Barristers, in his definitive planning note on the case, agreed it is a significant decision, one which arguably reduces the scope of judicial intervention by expanding the categories of matters that should be left to the pure planning judgment of the decision-maker rather than the court. He said, "While the two councils' appeals were dismissed, mainly on technical details of the individual appeals, their main arguments were endorsed by the Supreme Court. Most commentators believe this was a significant decision, but for apparently different, if not conflicting, reasons. Some have been quoted as viewing it as a positive step for the industry at large, whereas others see it as asserting the primacy of the development plan. What does seem clear is that the crucial issue is whether a local planning authority can demonstrate a 5-year supply of deliverable housing sites. Where the issue is clear-cut, then the scope for debate will be reduced. If the issue is more marginal, then planning appeals are likely to focus on a long, detailed analysis of sites and the prospects of deliverability."
Which leaves us with number one. And there may be little surprise among listeners to hear that Top of the Pops for 2017 is a Supreme Court decision that was widely welcomed by the industry, including British Property Federation and the Rating Surveyors Association, who intervened in the appeal. We are, of course, talking about S.J. and J. Monk versus Newbiggin, in which, back in March, the Supreme Court allowed an appeal against a much-criticised Court of Appeal decision that could have meant drastic increases in business rates of vacant premises undergoing renovations. Ian Fletcher, Director of Policy at the BPF, greeted it for putting a stop to business rates being charged on property undergoing redevelopment. He said, "Taxing property owners for buildings not making any income would have had a detrimental impact on the viability of refurbishments and regeneration up and down the country. At a time when uncertainty threatened business confidence, this would have been a step too far." Martin Davenport, president of the RSA, was delighted, saying the approach by the VOA to commercial buildings undergoing reconstruction works has been draconian and has stifled potential speculative development. Underlining the importance of the decision, he said that there are a number of outstanding appeals awaiting the outcome, and that the liability in some cases was substantial. Blake Penfold, business rates consultant, included the case in his roundup of the year's major rating decisions and said that the decision to allow only a nominal value to be applied in circumstances where substantial works were going on would be a considerable relief to property owners and developers. He added, "It will also help make alteration and refurbishment of properties more affordable by removing empty rate liability that might otherwise have been imposed based on the previous Court of Appeal rules. This is a victory for common sense and for the principle that non-domestic rates should be a tax on the value of occupation of property, not its potential occupation." However, commentators including James Suter, partner at Charles Russell Speeches LLP, and Denton's Brian Johnson, warned of bigger battles to come in the business rates field, including revaluation and the heavily criticised check-challenge appeal system. Perhaps a suitable case or two will surface in 2018. Thank you very much for listening to our 2017 Cases Roundup. Thank you, Jess, for contributing. We ask for feedback from our listeners. Should you have any alternative suggestions for cases that could be included, please tweet at Estates Gazette or at legal_EG.